Last April, after Dante Wright was shot and killed by police in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, protesters flooded the streets in what's become a sad, angry, and familiar ritual. They chanted, they marched, they yelled at the cops, they held up signs reading Black Lives Matter. But what those protesters didn't know, what they couldn't see, according to reporter Tate Ryan Mosley, is that they were being surveilled by the police.
I think it's definitely a reasonable concern that if you were a protester any of those nights in the second week of April, that there was some sort of data collected about you.
Tate writes for the MIT Technology Review, and she and her colleague Sam Richards found that after the killing of George Floyd, law enforcement in Minnesota built a high-tech operation to monitor protesters, activists, and journalists. According to Tate's reporting, they used tools to scour social media, track cell phones, and amass detailed images of people's faces. People who weren't charged with crimes. People who were exercising free speech. People who became unwitting test subjects for a new kind of policing.
Not only are we kind of in this crisis moment, we're also in a transformative moment, I think, for police technology.
Today on the show, what Tate found in Minnesota and why it might be coming to a police force near you. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about technology, power, and how the future will be determined. Stick around.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Good afternoon, everyone. Chief Madera Arredondo, the Minneapolis Police Department.
The surveillance program that Tate investigated began with a multi-agency task force known as Operation Safety Net. It was announced in February of 2021, and the stated goal was for law enforcement around Minneapolis to come together and prepare for the trial of Derek Chauvin, the officer who murdered George Floyd, and for the protests that would no doubt take place around the trial. 9 different agencies from the city, surrounding counties, and the state would be part of the operation, and they would get backup from 2 federal agencies.
The matter is that this will be a unified command. It will allow all of us to be able to respond metro and region-wide if needed, and it will allow great cooperation, coordination, and communication.
Chief Arredondo said the operation's first goal was to protect public safety, but that there was another one as well.
It is also very important that we ensure for everyone's constitutionally protected First Amendment right to gather and demonstrate peacefully.
They had been planning Operation Safety Net for months, months and months before it was officially announced. No one knew how the verdict was going to come out. There was the chance for another really large-scale protest movement and civil unrest that might come with that, like they had seen in the summer. And I think the city really didn't want to be caught flat-footed. The intent was to operate under a shared command structure. The idea was to increase communication, of course, you know, and join resources in the instance that there, you know, was a need for responding to civil unrest related to the trial, that you would have better communication in place and better police resources being able to kind of respond. And part of that was clearly sharing intelligence.
The idea of collaborating and sharing intelligence, how much of that came from how dramatic the protests had been around George Floyd's death and how, as you've said, officers felt they'd been caught flat-footed? Like, I'm wondering if going into Operation Safety Net, they thought, oof, man, we really, you know, we're not on the ball before, and now we need to step it up and have everybody talking.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it was a big part of the intention for creating shared intelligence mechanisms. Police groups, particularly when they're policing shortages, leverage resources, both technological and from a personnel perspective, from different agencies nearby. And I think that's really not how we think about policing policies, right? So every police agency has their own specific policies. They have their own budgets. They are held to different laws based on their own local jurisdictions. And so where it gets really confusing and murky, and we saw this play out in some ways with Operation Safety Net, is, okay, if I'm working for Minneapolis PD, I'm responding to something in Brooklyn Center, and my commanding officer is from Hennepin County, which First Amendment policy am I supposed to follow? And that's not super clear. And I think that kind of extends to technology.
The Chauvin trial began at the end of March. But even before there was a verdict, something unexpected and awful happened. On April 11th, 20-year-old Dante Wright was shot and killed by a police officer during a traffic stop in the nearby city of Brooklyn Center.
So on the night of April 12th, there were protests that broke out that were not specific to the trial. Obviously, a similar movement, similar theme, but they were not related to the verdict of the trial. And Operation Safety Net responded to those protests.
Footage of the night shows protesters and law enforcement facing off. You can see flashbangs and tear gas deployed. But what you can't see are the high-tech tools that Operation Safety Net was rolling out. Tate said that included cameras, facial recognition software, license plate readers, drones, social media monitoring, and geofencing. She also obtained a watch list that included photos and personal information identifying journalists and activists. One reporter who was able to get his data from the state and share it with Tate found 3 pages of details about where he went and what he did.
There was a tagged geolocation of a reporter with his name, his, you know, multiple photographs of him that was stored and then shared on a data sharing platform that we know was accessed by at least 3 agencies with Operation Safety Net.
These tools showed, on a remarkably granular level, what protesters and journalists were doing, sometimes down to the minute.
Those resources, when dispersed across the, I'll call it 11 agencies, are pretty powerful. When combined, it's pretty remarkable the extent of the surveillance capacities and intelligence sharing that was enabled by Operation Safety Net.
So let me see if I've got this right. You could have one police department or one agency that is using facial recognition and another that has overhead drone shots and a third that is looking at different social media profiles. And the result, when they all get together and share that information, is a pretty accurate picture of somebody and their activity. Is that right?
Absolutely. Policing agencies increasingly have incredible surveillance capabilities, especially those that are well-funded. They are increasingly militarized. And then when they have these joint agency responses with the intention and the real capability of sharing data and surveillance information amongst each other, what you end up with is a system that is incredibly powerful.
When we come back, why this kind of technology is becoming more and more common, even at a local level.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotarucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queen say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket. So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
It may not be surprising that police are watching protests. That's part of what they do, after all. But what is new, Tate says, is the kind of reach that modern technology can give them. One product that was used in Minnesota, for example, is called Intrepid Response, which is sold on a subscription basis by AT&T. You can think of it as Slack, but for SWAT teams, so they can swap information with a swipe of a finger.
There's a long history of police surveillance and police surveillance when it comes to First Amendment activity. What is new and novel is the technology and the accessibility of this technology to policing agencies. And that has really kind of fundamentally changed what it means to be in a public space and be protesting. Assuming that protesting in a public space can be done anonymously is naive at this point.
Tate says it's incredibly easy for law enforcement to de-anonymize someone. That is, cross-reference one piece of data, let's say a photo, with other sources to figure out who someone is. Now that protester is no longer a stranger in a crowd.
And so the ability to do risk assessments in a way that is accurate and measured while respecting the First Amendment is a pretty tall order. And I think some of the complexity with this story is that we're seeing technologies being a big part of the direction some of this is going.
Where did those technologies come from?
It's a whole mixed bag. We're seeing a lot of off-the-shelf technologies. Intrepid is something that is sold on a subscription basis by AT&T. We're absolutely seeing a lot of private vendors with things like facial recognition. But then at the same time, you know, you're seeing some military technologies. But, you know, I think clearly the direction that it's heading is private technology companies are doing a lot of the supplying. And what you're starting to see is kind of this murky intersection between what is public and what is private policing. And policing is largely being outsourced to technology. And that some of the activities that were previously kind of squarely in the public sector are now not so squarely in the public sector. I think that's part of what's really interesting about this moment is the amount of technology that is very easily accessible. The procurement channels and the public visibility of those procurement channels and the ultimate technology that is purchased by policing departments is really unclear.
I think that's an interesting thing for people to think about. While you might expect a national agency or the police department in a big city to have a lot of money and a lot of technological capability. It sounds like you're saying that some of these off-the-shelf products make it so that a smaller town or a smaller city has a kind of technological advantage that they wouldn't have had 15 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's part of what is interesting about the data sharing component as well. So there are technologies that make data sharing easier and data munging easier. And we're certainly starting to see some of that in a very real way, especially in the last 2 years. You know, brokered data has become a much bigger thing. And that's also true for policing groups. And the ability to marry different sets of data so that, you know, if you have information about me from my cell phone provider and then information about me from the DMV, combining that data is getting easier. And so even if you're a small agency in a small town, so long as you have access to state resources, you know, the state might be able to share information with you that actually comes from very, very sophisticated technology that your group didn't even purchase.
Operation Safety Net was supposed to wind down last year. Their website doesn't exist anymore. And a spokesman for the Minnesota Department of Public Safety told Tate it's not ongoing. But Tate found documents that suggest something different.
The agencies within Operation Safety Net to this day are contradicting themselves about whether or not it's ongoing or it's not ongoing. What we found was there are still active meetings with both the executive committee, which includes over 30 people, and the intelligence group that happen on a regular basis. In one meeting related to the executive team, they called it Operation Safety Net 2.0. It's very clear that that regular, as in weekly meetings of groups across these agencies, which include the FBI, are still happening.
So do you think it's safe to say that if someone went out to join a big protest in Minneapolis next week, someone's probably watching?
I would assume so. Absolutely, the surveillance and intelligence that came to a head with Operation Safety Net are still being applied to activists today.
There's a line in your story that I've been mulling over, that the idea that the protests that were intended to call attention to injustice committed by police, and you write this line, effectively served as an opportunity for those police forces to consolidate power, bolster their inventories, solidify relationships with federal forces, and update their technology. How do you square those things together, right? That this outpouring of activism seems to have created even more powerful technological and surveillance tools around it?
You know, I think it's a really, really hard question. I think the type of police we want in the United States needs to be a public conversation. And it's clear that it's changing, and there have been calls for it to change. And I think technology is one part of that story. And unfortunately, it's a part of the story that is not talked about enough, and there's not enough public information about it. We need to be having a lot of conversations about the ability of technologies to de-anonymize people and what that actually means to be in public.
It seems to me like it's fair to note that cops have been watching protests for as long as there have been protests, or maybe as long as there have been cops. What is it that you think makes this so fundamentally different? What is it about the technology that changes this equation?
We've entered a stage in technology where it's not just about data collection, but it's about data amassing. I feel like this conversation normally happens in the targeted ad space, but the technologies that are kind of fundamentally propping up targeted ads are not only being applied to advertising, right? And I think we see it across the board, and that includes public agencies and the police. I was told by one of my sources, who's an expert and studies this, she said that surveillance is a leash on free speech. It acts as a leash. It's a tug. And when surveillance gets to a point where the retaliation that can be enabled by that surveillance has a chilling effect, there's a real problem. And I think, you know, right now we're trusting policing groups with a lot of data about us when we enter a public space. And especially in movements where you're protesting the police, opening the door to retaliation that is enabled by surveillance technologies is a new page in the long history of policing and protest in the U.S.
Tate Ryan Mosley, thank you for your reporting and for talking with me.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Tate Ryan Mosley writes for the MIT Technology Review. She reported this story with Sam Richards. That is it for the show today. TBD is produced by Ethan Brooks. We're edited by Tori Bosch. Alicia Montgomery is the executive producer for Slate Podcasts. TBD is part of the larger What Next family, and we're also part of Future Tense, a partnership of Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. I want to recommend you go back and listen to Tuesday's episode of What Next, which taught me a lot about Ukraine's President Zelensky and what motivates him. All right, we will be back next week. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
And it would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.